Okay. The Paul Chambers Quintet with I Heard That from their 1959 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're going to be talking with a very special guest today about a very special subject. And I hope he's on.
I am indeed.
Hello, Charles.
Hello, Chief. How are you?
Difficulty hearing things, but sure. Proceed. The subject, really? Of course, is Jeffrey Epstein, and just about everybody knows now what the deal is with Jeffrey Epstein, and yet they still don't know because so much more needs to be uncovered. Jeffrey Epstein is an alleged multi-millionaire. Even people say that he's a billionaire. But that is doubtful. And more stories are suggesting he may not be the person that he has been saying for years that he is. But we have a particular interest in Jeffrey Epstein at Lead Stories, and our guide today, as is our guide many times when we want to understand complex Wall Street matters, is Charles Ortel, a retired Wall Street investment banker who has turned his attention to exposing fraud in the philanthropic world. And he's here to explain the ties that bind. But binding whom? Binding Epstein to the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation. So we are going to explore that today. We can add to the labyrinthine scam operations of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation the puzzlingly close personal relationship that its stewards, Bill and Hillary Clinton, have enjoyed with Jeffrey Epstein, a self-proclaimed financier facing a series of sex crime charges. So far, his lawyers are asking the courts that whatever happens right now, while things are being sorted out, that he should stay in his mansion until legal matters are cleared out. But in the meantime, Charles, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Eutrice.
You know, I can barely hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. I can hear you now.
Good.
Okay, so I feel a lot more comfortable. Okay, tell us about this man, Jeffrey Epstein, and how he gets into the picture with the Clintons.
Well, Jeffrey Epstein first came to intense focus in September-October 2002 timeframe, when New York Magazine had a long story about Epstein calling him the international man or international financier of mystery. And the reason he got such focus is that Epstein offered and did indeed provide a jet, purportedly that he owns, a 727, to Squire Clinton and members of Clinton's entourage, both in his office in Harlem and in his HIV/AIDS operation, as well as some movie stars and other hangers-on all across Africa. And this story is actually, when you go back and you look at it, it's quite revealing, because back then it was saying, you know, nobody really understands how Epstein came to be so very rich and what his real story is, et cetera. And recently, of course, he's back in prison. Actually, he's not in his mansion. He's in prison. This is all following on the heels of allegations that began in 2005 in Florida, that what he was doing was having co-conspirators pay money to underage girls to give him, quote, massages, that then very quickly turned into far more than massages. and hush money may have been paid to keep these girls silent, but ultimately it gets the attention of the authorities, and it rose up to the level where by July of 2007 or thereabouts, folks were interested in putting him away for a long time. And so there's a gigantic controversy brewing now, of course, seen through political lenses, about why wasn't Epstein disciplined more harshly back in 2007? Who let him off the hook? Why did people let him off the hook? And, you know, this was at a period where George W. Bush was president of the United States, of course, and we had the pivotal election period. Hillary had announced in January of 2007 that she was going to be the next president of the United States. A lot of the betting money in that time frame in July 2007 was all on Hillary, and we know what happened after the fact. So in the end, Epstein, the first time around, got what some believed to be a sweetheart deal where he was supposed to be in prison as a sex offender for 18 months, and instead the Bureau of Prisons down in Florida allowed him out of the prison 6 days a week to do, in quotes, work at one of his offices or mansions down in Florida. He, instead of serving 18 months, served only 13 months, and then he went back into relative obscurity, investing in theory, trying to redeem himself, only to find himself unceremoniously yanked off a plane, a private plane, on Saturday, and sent into one of New York City's area's harshest prisons, where he currently sits as people try to decide whether he gets out on bail, with the bail hearing coming forward on Monday. So with all that as background, I'm cynical, and I've been in New York for a while, and I know a lot of people here in New York. And when I heard the idea that this guy was a billionaire for the first time, I said, come on, let's get into his background. And when you get into his background, I think more and more is going to come out of this. This is a fellow who grew up in modest circumstances, who graduated from high school in 1969. He got admitted to Cooper Union, which is a plum school, he must have been smart, where at that time you would go there tuition free. And this, remember, is during the Vietnam War, so he was of draft age. For some reason, he didn't last long at Cooper Union, and then he went over to an NYU institute. He didn't last there at all, and he didn't graduate from college. So after 2 years, during the Vietnam War, he's out. We don't know what happened in those 2 years yet. In 71, summer 71 through the year-end 73. By 74 or 75, there's a lot of literature that suggests this guy was teaching at Dalton School. Now, I'll betray a little bit some lowercase prejudices here. I went to a competitive school at around that time. I graduated in 74, and I can tell you there's no way on earth that at Horace Mann, where I went, there were teachers of any serious discipline who didn't have a college degree. And so I don't believe that this guy was actually on the faculty. I think it's more likely he was a tutor. And, he probably, which would make a lot more sense to have somebody, who's 3 years older than a senior, tutoring people maybe below ninth grade, but, far enough ahead of high school kids that they would look up to him, and not so much older than high school kids that the kid would feel uncomfortable talking to the tutor about what the issues were and how that tutor could help them legitimately. So I think that period is going to come into intense focus. He apparently got a gig tutoring the chairman of the famous, or I should say legendary, chairman of Bear Stearns, Ace Greenberg's son, possibly in math or science, and through that interaction somehow landed a job at Bear Stearns in the 1975-76 time frame, which only lasted until 81. Now, I was in college from 74 to 78, business school till 80, and those, from a financial perspective, were dark years. Those were very difficult years. Inflation was raging, interest rates were really high. There was a lot of anxiety, both under Nixon, then under Ford, then under Carter. There were pressing international problems around the world. The Soviet Union was very militant. There was a lot of uncertainty, and so there wasn't very much business activity. In 1981, supposedly, he left Bear Stearns, and people are nosing around. It was it did he leave because he was a good actor and he just found a better opportunity, or was he pushed out? People are looking into that time frame. And they're looking now, finally, and this is Bloomberg, for example, news is looking at this, and mainstream news is looking into this, and they're questioning this assertion of they can't find any tangible evidence of deals he would have done that would have yielded enough pre-tax profits after paying capital gains or ordinary income taxes to put him in a place where he could have been a billionaire by 2002. Instead, what you find him connected to is one fellow who went to prison for a gigantic Ponzi scheme, which is called Tower Financial. I think the fellow's name is Hoffenberg. He, at one point, I believe, bought the New York Post and was a very flamboyant person who went to prison for, I think, like 18 years. And he's tied to abortive efforts in the 80s to acquire Pan Am and to acquire Emory Air Freight. But there's really no tangible evidence. He talks about having clients, his business strategy, he sets up a money management firm where he is only going to accept clients who will give him $1 billion per client. Now, you know, I worked in that area in that time frame, and somebody who would give you $1 billion of their money to manage would be a client that every single money management firm on earth with any experience would be jumping all over and to try to get that. That's not an easy thing to do, to find somebody who has a spare $1 billion that he wants to give a fresh upstart firm. So far, the only person we know who may have given Epstein that kind of money is Leslie Wexner, who had family money and was running, I think, the Limited and the Victoria's Secret and a bunch of other things like that. We have yet found anybody who will admit that he or she was actually a significant client of Epstein. We don't know the rates of return that Epstein would have delivered for a Wexner. And there are just so many unanswered questions about this guy. And now, because he's in the place that he's in, this is a tale that if he weren't connected to Donald Trump, if he weren't connected to the Clintons, if he weren't connected to a lot of famous people, this would be a massive story. But we're heading into an election, presidential election year, and we have on the heels of this the Me Too movement validly coming to light. This is, in many ways, I would argue, far worse than anything that we've heard so far. This is Jeffrey Epstein and perhaps acquaintances of Jeffrey Epstein, possibly clients of Jeffrey Epstein, tossing around underage girls and damaging them physically and emotionally, in some cases for their entire lives. This is the kind of behavior that really should be, and it's despicable. And it may well touch. Nancy Pelosi's daughter has tweeted out several days ago that this scandal is going to affect powerful people in both parties, including, quote, our faves, whatever that means, our favorites. So this is a place, frankly, I hope it's a unifying experience where we put aside the political lenses and we say, wait a minute, abusing vulnerable underage girls. Yesterday there was a story in NBC News, an extensive one, about a girl who's now, a woman who's now 32, who apparently was scouted by a female, I think, co-conspirator and predator, who approached this girl and said, listen, you look troubled in so many words. I'm aware of a wealthy gentleman. He's generous. Why don't you meet him? I'll be with you. You can trust us. Next thing you know, after multiple meetings and small money per meeting, Jeffrey Epstein allegedly rapes her when she was 15. And more people are coming out of the woodwork here. This should be a time and place where we say, of course, these allegations need to be taken seriously. He is now a convicted pedophile. He cannot get away with saying, he doesn't get the benefit of the doubt. He's a convicted pedophile who served more than a year in prison. And we need to understand here what really happened.
Tell us how Epstein's path and the Clinton's path and the Clinton Foundation's path all crossed each other.
Sure. So in 2007, after Epstein had been embroiled for almost 2 years, fighting charges against him, lawyers for Epstein drafted a letter, a 23-page letter, which a reporter from Fox, Malia Zimmerman, had a story on July 6, 2016. You can look it up. You can see the actual letter. And one of the arguments that the lawyers were using was you really should let Epstein off. He's a philanthropist. Specifically, one of the major things he did was co-founded or conceived of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative. And they go on to describe the that Epstein provided his jet for trips in 2002 and 3, and that this foundation was all involved to create the Clinton Global Initiative. And that actually happened in theory in September 2005, and that this great thing that Epstein had a major role in was fighting HIV/AIDS and climate change and assisting in economic development involving the poorest people in the world. So this is a letter written by one or more lawyers sent into a judge in the midst of a criminal proceeding, and it's a very serious matter when a lawyer lies about the reasons why you should give the defendant leniency. Well, the lawyer, I'm told, has an obligation to sort of stress test the claims that the client might make. And when a lawyer makes them on behalf of a client, either not having done due diligence to check that they were true, or knowing, in the worst case, that they were false, that lawyer can be subject to tremendous disciplinary action and worse. And any fair reading of the paperwork that is out there on the Clinton Foundation will reveal the following, that in 2002 and 2003, and indeed at no time, has the Clinton Foundation ever been authorized by the IRS to do any kind of work outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. In 2002 and 2003, there is no legally required audit of the financial statements available in the public domain so the potential donors can check and see, do you want to support this or not? That's a gross violation of New York law, California law, and many other state and foreign laws. Indeed, the fake audits that were put together by a firm called BKD, in my opinion, that they're fake, state in footnote 1, I believe, from memory, of each of the years for 2001, 2, 3, and 4, they state these financial statements are put together using accounting principles that are specifically not allowed for use inside the United States of America. So they say on their face, these are non-compliant audits. That's a serious solicitation fraud crime. So beyond that, as if that isn't bad enough, Bill Clinton was not an officer or director of any part of the Clinton Foundation until late in 2009, when he was inserted into something called Clinton Health Access Initiative, Inc. period, which I would argue is an illegally organized and operated false front charity. He only went on the board of the parent charity in November of 2013. So to make these false claims, and we don't yet have the back and forth. We have the letter going out, but we don't have any response. But the government must have a file on how the back and forth ended up with a decision to, instead of going after federal crimes in federal court, to do a state action and this deferred prosecution agreement. So that's one set of issues. The second connection to the Clintons, unfortunately for the Clintons, is somebody allowed a letter out under purporting to come from Bill Clinton on Monday, a press statement, that said, arrangements, I knew Epstein in 2002 and 2003. He lent us his plane for four trips in 2002. I went to his apartment and he came to my office, but that's really all I know about this Epstein guy. Well, the truth is, from what we know so far, that Epstein didn't operate alone. Robert Maxwell, the famous based in the UK, press magnate who died under mysterious circumstances, has a daughter whose name is pronounced, I believe, Ghislaine, but it's spelled Ghislaene. And she and Bill Clinton became acquainted by 1998 when Bill was under the spotlight for the Lewinsky allegations and the Paula Jones matter, and when he was being impeached but not convicted. And she began a process of trying to raise money, and may have raised money for the Clinton Presidential Library here in New York. And it's believed possibly at Epstein's, one of his residences. So Epstein and there's a Fox story out yesterday that Epstein also may have had a private dinner with Clinton in 1995 when Bill was in the process of trying to get reelected and needed more money. So they let this press release out that says, you know, I only got to know him in 2002, and the reason you say that is you don't want to trace connections back before the 1996 election, especially because there are allegations that foreign money was being funneled in to get Bill reelected, and that foreign money may have been funneled in to help Hillary get her Senate seat, which is, of course, illegal. So that part of it is a problem. And the second part of it is a problem that in 1998, Ghislaine Maxwell and Epstein put together a charity with a very funny name, C period, O period, U period, Q period Foundation. And this entity, on July 18th, 2006, makes a $25,000 contribution to William J. Clinton Foundation, which was not the name of the foundation on July 18th, 2006. It was the William J. Clinton Foundation. And 2006 is well after 2003, which was when the press release says that, Bill had lost contact with Epstein. Then, in 2013... by around September 25th, 2013, Ghislaine Maxwell by then had set up a new charity called the Terramar Project. And the Terramar Project makes a commitment to action valued at $1.25 million to at one of these Clinton Global Initiative meetings. This is in September of 2013. So the problem, there are many problems here, but one problem is with the Internet, try as you might to want to scrub it, there's just so much information in the public domain available about charities and about disciplinary actions and other and lawsuits that people are now actually doing work in the mainstream media and cross-checking to see that indeed the Clintons are, you know, very well connected with Epstein. And furthermore, Epstein is very well connected, having given donations to many, many politicians. I believe yesterday on the floor of the Senate, Minority Leader Schumer got up and demanded that the Labor Secretary step down because he was involved in that negotiation I mentioned in July 2007 forward. Well, today we come to realize that Schumer has taken tens of thousands of dollars in political contributions from Epstein. The other thing I should mention here, the press is trying to pitch this as, well, we see Trump with Epstein in a photo here and maybe at Mar-a-Lago there. When we look at one thing that's extremely damaging, and that is the flight logs for Epstein's plane, which are available and out there in the public domain, people to date have not yet caught on to the fact that it's not important just to look for Bill Clinton on these flights. You've got to look for acolytes of Bill Clinton's. Doug Band is on these flight logs. Ira Magaziner, who runs the HIV/AIDS operation and the Clinton Climate Initiative, which actually legally doesn't exist, the latter one, is on these flight logs, as is a gentleman called Eric Nonacs, N-O-N-A-C-S. He's on the flight logs. And I haven't checked every single page of the flight logs, but I would guess people are going to do that. And they're going to see that it's not enough to look at the four, now maybe six trips that Bill was on. You've got to look at, what about all the other Clinton Foundation or Clinton presidential office, ex-presidential office employees who are on these planes? And what about the other plane trips? And what happened in the international airspace inside these planes to any of these underage and young and unattached women? And for that matter, if there were any unattached young males, what happened in that airspace? And what happened in international waters? Involving Bill Clinton and these people and these many other hangers-on on these expeditions, none of which were authorized as Clinton Foundation work, because, again, the Clinton Foundation was only supposed to be doing work in Little Rock, Arkansas, setting up a place to store the presidential records that were created or received from January 20th, 1993 to January 20th, 2001, and giving scholars across the political spectrum and members of the public a chance to study those records. That's it. That's what this thing was supposed to do, not fly around Africa and India in private planes in Europe.
And in international waters, what kind of law applies? I mean, it's a straightforward issue when you have underage women and men being transported or having a good old time on a private plane, but in international waters, what law applies there?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but as a guess, you know, just thinking it through, it will be a question of endless debate where people will run up, the government in a given country will have resources to make an argument, and the defendant will then construct a counter-argument, and it will take many years to resolve the question. But, you know, simplistically put, I don't believe that international waters or international airspace is actually regulated. I could be wrong, but I don't believe yet that it is.
So, I mean, it's a guess, but what could possibly be happening on a plane where you have a former president of the United States, high-level officials of the U.S. government, and these highly questionable conditions prevailing in international waters? Could you take a guess as to what that might be?
Well, so my understanding is that this plane and others like it are not set up like, you know, a first-class cabin in British Airways. These are planes that have bedrooms and beds and who knows what. And all kinds of monkey business is, and worse could happen here. And if you're that underage person and you're on the outbound leg of a trip to, I don't know, somewhere in Africa, and you know, and you've got a passport, but it's in the care, let's say, of your minder, and you've got no money, and you're in this place in the first place because you don't, let's say, have a parent who's looking after your interest. It's kind of like, you know, why would parents let their young children sleep over at Michael Jackson's house? It doesn't make any sense. And so you've got, by definition, vulnerable people. And this is why, you know, when I got into the Clinton Foundation stuff in the first place, I'm not in favor of having a gigantic government, but it does seem that we need a government strong enough to at least be a counterweight to protect the most vulnerable among us, the young, the elderly, the sick, mentally challenged, from people who would do them harm, which now appear to be possibly former and aspiring presidents and all these powerful people. So, you know, the first thing, you know, when my children were much younger, if somebody had said, hey, and indeed, my children went down to a fundraiser several times in Central Park where Hillary Clinton was there. And I'll never forget, my youngest came back. She might have been 8. And she looked at me, and she's very funny. And she said, Dad, you're not going to believe Hillary Clinton. You know, first of all, she kissed, what did she do? She kissed my brother, which she wasn't happy about, her elder sibling, and then she looked at me. She's got scary eyes, Dad, googly eyes. They're scary. She's a scary person. But, you know, when you're a parent and somebody says, well, look, here's the project. You're 15 years old. You're a girl. There's a party involving all these single men and former presidents, and they want to go on a month-long trip across Africa. Don't worry, all your expenses will be covered. You know, we just like your permission. I mean, what parent would let a 15-year-old girl, let's say, or a 17-year-old girl, or for that matter, a young boy, go along on a trip like that? It's crazy.
On the manifest, do you see many times when both Hillary and Bill were traveling together to these far-flung places?
I have not. I have to confess, I haven't looked at every page of the 93 pages, and it's all in handwriting, which I have a harder time deciphering. I tend to focus on type stuff. I did do a quick scan, and I have looked at summaries of it. There's a great story in the Washington Examiner today, this morning, which already shows that it wasn't 4 trips, it was at least 6 trips. And it does identify a number of the people who were on that flight. As a guess, we have people around the world looking at that flight log, checking it, cross-checking against other public records in countries around the world. We're going to know a lot more about it. I haven't seen, short answer, an example of when Hillary and Bill were on that plane. But I do know that there's something, a company called InfoUSA, a gentleman by the name of Vinod, last name Gupta, Vinod Gupta, who was forced to disgorge a lot of money and leave InfoUSA, a public company where he had been chairman, because he had routed millions of dollars to Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton to fly in private planes who knows where, stay in fancy hotels who knows where, and also to pay Bill consulting fees while Hillary was, I believe, just senator. But at a time when Vinod Gupta was also a donor to the Clinton Foundation and to the American India Foundation, to which Bill Clinton is connected, none of those fees were disclosed in the various charity, Clinton Foundation and American India Fund Foundation, as should have been the case. So short answer is I don't know specifics yet, but I think, you know, the game is on, and amateur and professional investigators around the world are now going to be getting to the bottom of what truly did happen.
Was Epstein along the, with Bill and Hillary at any time on these interesting trips, along with the targets, meaning donors?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's there are various and sundry accounts of that, and the flight logs would confirm that. Again, I don't know about Hillary, but definitely Bill, and definitely Ira Magaziner, and definitely Eric Nonax, and who knows how many other Clinton Foundation and, you know, and Doug Band and other presidential friends were on Epstein's jet in all the locations around the world. But we're now, what I like to do when I think about things like this is to put together a comprehensive timeline with sources. And now we have that. I have what I need already, but with this, we're going to have an avalanche or a gusher or whatever you want to say of people from differing perspectives are going to come forward and say, well, I saw them here in Ghana, and I saw them there in Nigeria, and here they are in Mozambique, and here's this. And all that stuff's going to come flooding out. In addition to which, you ask the question, what are people doing right now? And you have, in Epstein's little black book, lots of very famous, went public, lots of very famous people are in that black book with their phone numbers and email addresses and sundry. Many of these people are married or were married at the time. And they're sitting there saying, oh, my gosh, you know, what is Epstein going to, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? And the FBI, the U.S. attorney was very clever on Monday saying, if anyone has information about this case, please come forward now. With the clear undertone being, you know, you better come forward and tell us before we come knocking on your door and interrogating you. So there are a large number of people, I would guess, who are quite nervous right now. There, yesterday, as I said, two people came forward with new tales of being raped or attacked, or both, by Epstein and his cronies. More is going to come forward. We know that in the indictment, which is out there in the public domain, there are references to Executive 1, Executive 2, and so and so. As a guess, there are additional sealed indictments. And we know that unlike, you know, the first investigation of the Clinton Foundation from 2001 to 2005, unlike the investigation of Hillary for misusing classified information, this time it's a real investigation, at least for now. And when the FBI and U.S. Attorney's and Department of Justice want to go against you hard, my understanding is that they can go against you really hard. I mean, forget what they did to Manafort and Roger Stone. Here you've got crimes that are really bad. All crimes are bad, but some are worse than others. And this is a longstanding pattern and practice of abusing, raping vulnerable girls so far. And by people in positions of great power who should have known better. And, you know, Lord help us if it turns out what we have here are people, let's say, in academia or in these boarding schools or in other charities or multinational CEOs. I mean, politicians are bad enough. But what if we have major authority figures also doing this? Then there will be a broad outcry, a justifiable outcry from across the political spectrum to actually drain the swamp, to really get to the bottom of what happens when there's a power imbalance and people at the top are lecherous rapists. You know, why would an institution let that go? Why were these decisions made? Who enabled all this? How come this wasn't rooted out a long time ago? And is this a whole operation something that was designed to create leverage, that it was actually maybe led or directed or financed by government operatives, maybe inside and outside this country? Is this a gigantic blackmail operation? These are the types of questions that deserve
this
answers.
This is what's running through my mind. First of all, this is not a normal business model to follow. This is not a normal business model. And so it's creeping into my head that they get the advantage of being outside of official borders and barriers. They're in an international space, and supposedly that gives them some degree of protection against prosecution because they are en route to some place. So all these shenanigans are going on while they are suspended over basically international space. Number two, you have the question here. We don't know who exactly. We know Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton had made these kinds of trips. There were reports of rapes and sexual orgies and whatnot occurring on these flights with very high-level people. And it occurs to me that it could be a way, as you said, of producing evidence that later can be used to blackmail them into coughing up more money. If you don't tell us that you would be able to help us by getting, you know, a couple of million here and a couple of million there, you know, it could make your life very, very uncomfortable. How do you verify something like that?
In this case, I think it's only going to come if we, the people, stand up together and ignore our political differences and say, and I would guess particularly people on the left, but I know more people on the right. I don't want to speak for them, but I would say that good people across this country must now stand up and say, now, wait a minute. We didn't sign up to live under a Stasi state, East German police state, with the tools of technology harnessed against us. To create a system where perhaps the CIA or some other security agencies vacuum up the internet, vacuum your personal file, and wait to find people who are coming up the ranks who want to be elected leaders, let those people get into office, and then, as James Comey did, tried to do with Trump, go see the incoming president, and as Comey did, I believe, early in January, and say, listen, we have this file here. And who knows what the next part of the sentence was. You know, we don't yet know the degree to which, and Schumer said it actually, back before the inauguration or immediately thereafter, he said something like, you know, you don't want to challenge the securities agencies. They can make your life hell, was his unsolicited advice to Trump. Well, really what we need in this country is balance on that. We can't give unlimited authority to a known security agency or to some other security agency that lies in the shadows to, you know, look at everything we've done electronically and on this phone call and elsewhere, put that in a file, and then, you know, when the moment comes, decide, you know, we're going to make your life miserable. We're the government. You can't stop us. You can't touch us. You know, we're going to make your life. If you fight us, Michael Flynn, for example, we're going to put your son away, or we're going to do this or that. We'll bankrupt you. That's the kind of power that our founders stood up for or stood against in 1776, that no government should have that type of power. The government works in theory for we the people and not the other way around. We're not subjects in this country. We're certainly not subjects to the intelligence agency. So when I think about this period, and I think about, for example, John Brennan, I wonder how that man got a security clearance in the first place, given his history and background. I mean, he admitted to being a communist. and were in theory fighting a war at the time against radical Islamic terrorists. He converts to Islam. I don't know what business experience he had. I don't know what, you know, he's a very questionable background from my standpoint. And he's mouthing off even now, saying outrageous things about the President of the United States, which I don't think have been proven by anybody yet. And, you know, why should a leader of the CIA be political? Why should the leader of these intelligence services be political? If what we're doing is trying to protect the American people, I don't think terrorists or, you know, sworn enemies go and say, well, you know what, today I'm only going to kill Republicans or I'm only going to kill progressives. I think our sworn enemies, and we do have them, are just primarily interested in damaging America. And so therefore, our intelligence services must, in my opinion, be apolitical, but I don't think they are. I think there have been times when they've been anti-left. I think there are times when they're anti-right. And what is deeply troubling is whether they're now pro-crony capitalism. I mean, think of the secrets that these intelligence agencies might get and be able to sell to the person of the highest bidder to give an investor or a corporation an advantage over another person. I mean, this is enormously valuable information that can be monetized. And for that matter, what are the connections of the security agencies into these tech giants, be it Facebook? I mean, how is Facebook really managed? Where does that information really go that we all so willingly put into Facebook or telegraph by making Google searches or using Twitter? I mean, who's looking at that information? How do we know it isn't being studied closely by one or more intelligence agencies inside and outside this country? These are the type of deep and apolitical questions that I think must be answered as a matter of urgency.
But let's ask a political question. How is it that even now, with these things coming to light, the Clintons remain completely untouchable, it seems? No real investigation has been launched into the Clinton Foundation, into the operations of the office of the then senator, the travel that she was doing. Nobody's really taken this on as an issue that needs to be cleared up.
Well, how do you say I think that? The first answer, Yatrice, to the question, the first part of the answer is that in the period January 93 to January 2001, my opinion is that the Clintons vacuumed the files, their allies vacuumed the files to find, you know, that we know that FBI files were illegally obtained or were obtained, and we don't know who reviewed them. We don't know if that's all the FBI files. And mind you, FBI files don't just contain facts. They contain suppositions, unproven allegations, all kinds of stuff, and they're not supposed to be shared with the public. So we know they took them. What we don't yet know is how many more things they got, how much advantage they got over rivals in the Democratic Party, over enemies in the other parties. We just don't know that yet. We don't know the degree to which the Clintons may have inserted loyal allies into supposedly apolitical jobs when, in fact, the people are partisan political people. We don't know whether, even under George W. Bush, whether people had, from the Clinton orbit, stayed in place and were able to continue their process of getting dirt on opponents. Because, after all, if you've got the clearance, I suppose you can work on the weekend, you have access to these files. And so we just don't yet know that. And one part of the answer may be that people are loath, have until recently been loath to cross the Clintons, particularly in the early period when it was assumed that Hillary would be the President of the United States January 20th, 2009, for 8 years. So that's one part of your answer. But I don't know anything about ongoing investigations other than what's in the public domain. But what I will say is it is a matter of public record, the Horowitz report, that the FBI opened multiple investigations into the Clinton Foundation. We know from later reporting these have been either re-energized or are still open now, January 2016. We know from the IRS itself that investigations have been opened starting July 2016. These are complex matters, as we've been talking about this now together since May of 2016. We don't yet know the full contours of this scandal. I mean, there are multiple stories yesterday that the Epstein scandal taken together with everything else could be the largest scandal in world history. And I, you and I have been saying that for months, if not years.
Well, how does this compare to the Madoff scandal in terms of the possible money involved?
Well, Madoff is a people variously say that the Madoff scandal is $40 to $60 billion. This scandal, by my calculation, counting not just the Clinton Foundation but allied messes, is certainly in the hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of dollars. And this is, in my view, these unregulated globalist scams are charity Madoffs. You know, these are, you think you're giving money to fight HIV/AIDS or to help the poor people of Haiti. In reality, you know, and you send in, I send in $20 and you send in $50 and you don't really care. Frankly, it's not worth your effort to make sure the $50 actually reached Haiti. And millions of generous people do this. That's a lot of money. And on top of which, UN schemes and other multilateral schemes, you know, no one's asking the simple question, oh, wait a minute. We sent hundreds of billions towards Africa, maybe trillions towards Africa. How come there aren't many roads in Africa? How come there aren't many electrical power stations? How come there aren't that many hospitals or airports? Why are the people of Africa largely still living in rural areas and not concentrating in cities? Why isn't there infrastructure for cities? Why isn't there clean water? Nobody seems to be asking those questions. Instead, they're happy to let the UN and other do-gooders, you know, send, as I say, billions and billions of dollars to all these far-flung places with nobody actually checking to see that there's been a measurable and positive impact in the recipient countries, or furthermore, nobody checking to see how many people, both in the donor government and the recipient government, are stealing potentially large portions of that money. We don't want to seem to do any of that checking because we say, well, you know, it's the charity world. Only good people would give money away. Nobody would be so bad as to steal money from a charity. Well, I think we're going to find out soon that many people are that bad and continue to be that bad. And unfortunately, many of these people are elected leaders and former elected leaders of countries where people should know a lot better than to do this.
Well, you've given us a grand tour. There's still much more to be told, I'm sure. But it seems like you're opening up a whole new can of worms here about supposed charity fraud. And it's now combining with political fraud and your standard issue fraud. This is it seems to be a whole new world of crime.
And it's very sad. I mean, you know, I have been confined here to New York City for a while for reasons that I won't get into, having to do with a sick member of my family who's passed away, sadly. But, you know, I have traveled extensively throughout this country, and we've spent trillions of dollars on government. We spend about $6 trillion a year. Why are there so many blighted areas in the center of America's once great cities in 2019? Why is that the case? You know, why aren't we trying to fix that? Why are our schools, you know, many buildings falling down? Why are our teachers complaining they don't have supplies for kids? Why are American kids not testing? You know, we delight in the World Cup women winning that thing four times. Why aren't all America's students winning the World Cup of education? To me, we need to get that right. We need to make sure that, you know, monies are flowing properly inside the United States to make this country what it could be, realize the true American dream for everybody. And we certainly shouldn't be, you know, failing to do that at home while we're letting trillions of dollars collectively from the donor countries go to countries that aren't seeing any economic improvement.
Well, Charles, we have to leave it there for today. And, of course, we will come back and finish it up as best we can to people's satisfaction so they understand things. So we've gone today beyond the Clinton Foundation. We see the connection with Jeffrey Epstein, and we're seeing more and more connections, and this opens up a trillion-dollar world of crime, and people are getting away with it. Hopefully that will end soon. But thanks so much for all the time that you have pumped into researching and trying to come up with some answers and share them with us. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Trish. All the best. Bye.
All right. So we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks for joining us today. And tomorrow being Free Your Mind Friday.